You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Earlier today, I caught up with National MP for Botany, Christopher Luxon, as part of my weekly interview with him. We spoke about travel bubbles with New Zealand and other countries, local health boards, and New Zealand's mental health crisis. We also discussed a recent article from Stuff, which has shown Luxon uses his government accommodation funds to rent property from himself. A couple of weeks ago, you spoke to me about the importance of opening up a travel bubble with Australia, and this has now happened. Would you like to see a travel bubble with any other countries?
Yeah, well, I think it is exciting that the travel bubble has opened, and it's desperately needed because it has been quite heartbreaking for the tourism sector dealing without Australian visitors. Just remembering there's, you know, 1.2 million Australians coming here typically each year. It's interesting to me. It's better late than never, but frankly, the Australians have been doing this since October last year and managing it incredibly well. And so all we're doing is replicating what they were doing and what we were arguing for a long time. But yes, this shouldn't be the end of it. What we should be now looking forward to is making sure we get quarantine-free travel between Samoa, Tonga and Fiji, because that's very important for us from two points. One is to reconnect families here in New Zealand with the Pacific Islands, but also the economic benefit for both the islands, but importantly for New Zealand's horticultural sector, is also really important. So we've got to keep moving forward and keep finding ways through this as we go forward with it. I think the Pacific Islands is the next logical place for us to open up.
The alternative side to a travel bubble, I'm also interested in your thoughts on travel into New Zealand from India being temporarily suspended. Do you think this is reasonable?
Yeah, I think as we go forward, we have to take a risk-adjusted approach to the border. It's the way in which you do a lot of things that involve risk. If I think about my old life around aviation, there's a lot of risk management that you take a risk management approach to sort of how you run a business like that or how you operate in an aviation industry. But what I would say is that, you know, we seem to have identified India, but there's also challenges with those variants in Brazil and also the US. And so, you know, we make sure we get a consistency of treatment of high-risk countries. But actually, separating potential returnees and visitors from high-risk, medium-risk, low-risk countries, actually having dedicated MIQ facilities for each of those statuses, are things that we can do around that MIQ facility to make sure that we are managing the risk in a much better way. I do think what's also interesting is sort of a bit of a diversion, but you know, in essence, by opening up that Australian bubble, 40% of our rooms in MIQ were actually taken up by Australians, and we only had a handful of cases of Australians coming to New Zealand with COVID. And so those, you know, having now that quarantine-free bubble, that 40% of those spaces should be being utilised to actually bring back split migrant families, a whole bunch of people that we desperately need in this country. When I go up and down New Zealand, it's really interesting. We really are missing a whole bunch of skills that have been provided through working visas and other things, and we need to be able to do some work on that front as well. You know, we have, for example, you know, great people who've come here from the Philippines by themselves, who might be a nurse in our healthcare system, but their husband and their young baby is stuck in the Philippines. They're about to leave to go back to the Philippines because they've been separated from them for over a year and a half. And we're going to do a vaccination rollout, which is we're the second worst in the OECD at the moment. And we're going to miss those key workers that we need to be able to get that task done. So we need to join things up and think about things in a strategic sense to how they all join up and how they connect with each other.
There's another topic related to healthcare I'd like to discuss. I've seen you've been active in your electorate, Botany, trying to reinstate the local overnight medical care. Could you talk a little bit about this to me?
Well, look, I mean, the challenge in Botany and East Auckland in general is there's 130,000 people living there. There'd be another 30,000 people before 2030. So today it is already bigger than Dunedin, it's bigger than Tauranga. And we have very poor services in terms of transport, health, a whole bunch of things. And so in the health space, the challenge was that we have one facility that offers overnight emergency services called East Care Health. And essentially the DHB was funding them, withdrew the funding. East Care Health carried on for a couple of years providing that service themselves at a loss because it was important to the community. And then they've had to withdraw that service. We had 10,500 people sign a petition within 3 days before Christmas saying that was really important to them. They want that service reinstated. And it's actually quite cheap to do it in the scheme of things, you know, for the DHB to fund that service again and use EaseCare to deliver that service to the people of Botany and Pakuranga. So I think, you know, for us, we've had a public meeting about it with the chair and the CEO of the DHB. We had 400 people come along, which was fantastic. We've got a process in place where there's two actions. One is really making sure that we can review that overnight service and have an answer by June 30. And secondarily, work on a hub, health hub strategy where we can bring more healthcare services into the area so that people don't have people going outside of East Auckland in order to go secure those services, whether it be oncology, ophthalmology, spirometry, a whole bunch of basic healthcare services. So that's really our focus. At a national level, obviously mental health was a big issue for us this week as well, and I think, you know, mental health is at a crisis, and the government really has is fudging the numbers, and what we're frustrated with is that we want to make sure that the investments we're making in mental health are having an impact on people who desperately need to access those services, but when the government doesn't record the targets and officials start to sanitise the data, which is what's been happening, and changes the way we look at it, whether you look at all the mental health NGOs across the country, you know, they're all very, very frustrated with the lack of openness and transparency that we're seeing around mental health reporting and metrics. And that's important because, you know, if we're going to get services to people and we don't know how wait times are happening for youth and adolescents at the moment, which are, you know, blown out. In my area, they've gone almost a third, you know, extra in terms of people waiting to access those services. Well, we want to know that because then we can change how we spend the money in order to put it behind the things that are going to have the most impact to be able to, you know, to help people the most when they desperately need it. So, yeah, so healthcare, I think, is a big issue for the country, but also in my area in East Auckland too.
So obviously you do need to get the numbers, but once you have them, what do you do to fix New Zealand's mental health crisis?
Well, we've treated mental health over the last 30 years, irrespective of which government's been in power, as sort of a second-class health issue. And there's no doubt about it. It is going to be a preeminent issue today, but going forward, we're going to need to invest significant amounts of money in mental health support services. But when you invest money, you need to make sure that programs are working. Do you know what I mean? Because just announcing stuff and saying you're going to spend money on things and actually not following through again, which I think is a big issue with this government, and actually securing different results and different outcomes is really important. And moving money from things that are working, from aren't working to those that are working, is what we've got to do. And so a lot of frontline health, you know, services, particularly youth and adolescents at the moment, for young people to access mental health services, you know, I know in my area, I think it's gone from like 16 days to 25 days in less than 3 years. Well, that matters, you know, that time matters, and we need to make it much quicker in order to do that. So, but the question is, you need to be very clear on the core metrics that we're trying to improve. You need to know what drives them, what causes them, and then you need to put money and programs towards them to make that work. But it doesn't help when the big mental health report is delayed its release, and then when it's released, it's got metrics that we've previously been tracking for the previous, you know, 5-10 years, and it's not there. And that's because the government doesn't like the story, which is that fundamentally mental health system is in worse shape now than when they came to power, and they've had 4 years to fix it, and they aren't fixing it, and they're not making progress on it. They're talking about it, they're not doing anything about it, and there's a big difference between talking and doing stuff, and we owe it to people to do things for them, to solve their problems, to have an impact on their lives.
Talking about healthcare sort of generally, both in relation to the mental health crisis and also the local issue in Botany, do you think the government should be putting more money into healthcare? Would you like to see district health boards receive more funding? Would that help in Botany for EaseCare?
Yeah, it does. I mean, first and foremost, you've got to, you know, there's a lot of, absolutely, I mean, the bottom line is absolutely we need to make serious investments in our infrastructure, including health, education, transport, across this whole country. And I think we need to go on a real nation-building exercise to build for the country that we want to see emerge in New Zealand in 2040. And if you start to think about what that looks like, it's a really quite, you know, it could be really exciting. But we've got to go to work and we've got to go get these things done. And so the problem is that everyone wants more money for everything, and health is one of those areas. Even if we had all the money we wanted in the world, we'd still want more. And so you end up in a very difficult world of making trade-offs about what you can and can't afford to do. but we need to fundamentally change it. If I look at Counties Manukau and Zenith to them as a DHB, they've had huge amounts of population growth and they aren't funded for that population growth that's happened over the last decade or so. Alongside that, it doesn't help though when a government in 2018 can't run a census and gets the data wrong, because that data is used to build schools, hospitals, transport links, etc. So, there are just getting, again, it's join up and getting the basics done well so that we can actually get the planning done right, so that we can actually get services to people who desperately need them. But no doubt about it, we need to spend a lot more on healthcare, but we need to be smart about how we're going about it as well, because there is still a lot of wastage. When you've got IT systems and people's time taken up with just managing bureaucracy because we don't have, centralised health records or good IT systems that are talking to each other, and there's lots of workarounds, that's just not great.
There's one other question I'd like to ask about. So this morning, Stuff published a piece about how you and a number of other MPs, including Simon Bridges and Judith Collins, have used your government accommodation allowance to rent properties off yourself, and uniquely you've done this for both your electorate office and your Wellington accommodation. Do you think this is potentially taking advantage of your position as an MP?
Look, no. I mean, what happens is that it's a very standardised thing. As part of remuneration of being an MP, you get a base salary, and also if you live from outside of Wellington, you can have two options. One is you can either go stay in a hotel and have that reimbursed, or you can actually rent or purchase your place and get a living away from home allowance. And so that's what that is around apartment. And all MPs across the country, all MPs in Parliament would do that. And with respect to the property, which is our electorate office, that's been checked off with parliamentary services. It happens. It is a thing where MPs will purchase a property in order for, because they think it's a great location. In my case, we had a very small office. We're trying to do a lot of constituency work. We're doing more constituency work than we've ever got, with lots of people coming in with housing, immigration issues, in a central location on bus routes with disability access. It's a really great base for us to actually be in. That's all checked off. There's full market rents appraisal. The parliamentary services are very comfortable with the fact that they think they're getting good value for money. They think that the environment's a good one to serve constituents in, and that we've followed all the processes to make sure that they've signed off on it. They sign off on the contract, make sure they're happy with everything, and that it's fair and reasonable. So I'm very comfortable with those arrangements.
That was Christopher Luxon, MP for Botany, talking about travel bubbles and health issues in New Zealand as part of my weekly catch-up with him.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.